Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Now, Simon Harris, Taoiseach, Minister for Foreign Affairs and Trade and leader of Fine Gael, you're very welcome to
Thank
the studio.
So much,
Thank you
Good
for
morning.
Coming in.
Thank you.
When you call the election in November, do you think you'd be back in power thanks to a deal with Michael Lowry, a deal that we now see today in particular was really weak at the seams?
Well, look, I think when we called the election in November, I think the one thing that's certain when you call an election is it's almost impossible to predict the outcome in Irish elections. And there's always so much uncertainty in terms of predictions and punditry when the election starts. And obviously then the people of Ireland have their say, and we the politicians, have to deal with the outcome of that. I think it is important to remember that after the election, there was a lot of engagement by my own party and indeed by the Fianna Fáil party with a number of groupings and parties in the Dáil. I personally sat down with the leader of the Labour Party and their negotiating team. My negotiating team met with the Labour Party on a number of occasions. We met with the Social Democrats. I met them directly. So did my team on a number of occasions. And of course, we met the regional independent groups too. And fundamentally, I suppose the job after an election is to form a government, to get on with the people's business and to put something in place that can last for 5 years and deliver on the many pressing issues that face people.
It was clear though that you wanted that deal with the regional independents pretty quickly, because we saw that the deal for the Ciarán Cóirle position was done. But I just want to go back to the negotiations themselves, because you were in the room for the crucial parts when it was signed off on. I mean, did you not see when they said they'd want opposition speaking rights that that was going to be a huge problem?
It never arose. I mean, let me be crystal clear in relation to this, and I can be categoric and cannot be contradicted by any person in relation to this. That did not arise.
So they came back at you with this after the deal was done.
So maybe if I can just kind of explain the way I see it. So, I mean, the negotiations that I and my team, and indeed Micheál Martin and his team for his party, were involved in was about policy, about the programme for government, and let's be truthful, ultimately also about the composition in terms of the cabinet and ministers of state positions. So it was about policy and then the composition of government. After the government is agreed, it's obviously up to every grouping in the Dáil to engage with the Ciarán Cóirle in relation to their speaking rights. And it did come as a surprise to me that the regional independent group had written to the Ciarán Cóirle, sought to be a technical group in the Dáil. And indeed,
see, it shouldn't have come as a surprise to you, because you're dealing with Michael Lowry and you should know that you need to close all the gates before you go into the field with them.
No, I should also know what my job is and what my job isn't. And the job of the executive, the job of the government is in relation to government. The job of speaking rights in the Dáil, the composition of the Dáil, who sits where, who can speak, what they can speak on, be entirely inappropriate for that to be a role for the government. It's always been a role for the Oireachtas, for the Ciarán Cóirle. And indeed, in fairness to the Ciarán Cóirle, she gave a very clear definitive ruling on that this week, which I welcome, because it brings clarity to the matter, because this was going on way too long and quite frankly driving people crazy when there's big pressing issues that people want us to get on with.
Then you have these letters, which I read this morning, you're very annoyed about, from three of those independents saying that their support will be based on case by case. Are you very annoyed about that?
Well, I don't want to describe emotion to my feelings, but look, what do I know? I know this. When Fianna Fáil,
but you gave a lot to get support for nine people. Now you haven't got nine, it seems.
Well, let me just talk about that. When Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and the independents sat down to negotiate a programme for government, there were 95 TDs involved in that process. When you count up the TDs in Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the regional independent group plus the two Healy Rays, 95 TDs. That gives the government a very significant majority in the Dáil, and I think that's important for stability. Now, you do have four members of the regional independent group who did write that letter and say that they were going to support the government on a case-by-case basis.
Is that what Michael Lowry said?
I think he's in that letter, but didn't say to us.
I don't think he said case by case in his letter, which makes it different from the other three letters.
Sure, so three. So my apologies, three.
But it sounds as though now you might be doubtful of the support of four of the nine that you've done the deal with.
Well, the two points I'd make. Firstly, I'm not doubtful of the support, because these individuals were in the room negotiating a programme for government. They negotiated intensively in good faith. And indeed, I heard the comments they made on the plinth in terms of supporting the government in
thick
the implementation of that programme, thick and thin, good days and bad days. So that's the first thing. The second thing, though, is even if you were to apply the case-by-case basis, there are still 91 government TDs whipped, if you like, and that also gives the government a sizable majority. The point I'm trying to make to listeners this morning is that this government has a significant Dáil majority. It has a stable Dáil majority, and I believe it can last 5 years.
But are you calling it
five budgets?
Are you calling it a majority of 91 now, not 95?
I believe it's 95, and I believe it's 95 based on the fact that those people negotiated the programme for government in good faith, and I respect their mandates and respect the fact they did that.
In retrospect, though, here, like, what you were doing was shoring up support. I mean, some would say pulling a fast one by getting a raft of independents in when you only needed two. You went for nine, and now you're left in a situation where you have the tail wagging the dog. Michael Lowry is in charge here.
So I would reject every part of that assertion, being very respectful of doing so.
You didn't need the nine, you know, and now you're in this messy situation.
Well, I'll tell you why I think we did need the nine. If, and I can't remember the number now, but if you look at the last government, during the lifetime of a government, things happen. And you can lose members from your ranks. And I don't want to start singling individual TDs, but my good colleague and friend Joe McHugh, for example, would have left the Fine Gael Party over the issue of MICA, or the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party over the issue of MICA. Mark McSharry would have left the Fianna Fáil Party. There can be attrition in terms of the number of TDs. And when I spoke to people across the country, and indeed when I know the instability that is in the world and the potential economic risks to our country and to the European Union, you want to make sure you have a majority that is sizable enough to provide that stability for the years ahead, for the difficult days, for the difficult decisions. And that's why myself and the Taoiseach were eager to build a government that had a sizable enough majority. Mm-hmm. And that was the motive behind it. In relation to, because, you know, there's a lot of focus on one individual and one person's name. And a couple of things I'd say on that. I think it's utterly pejorative and offensive to other independent TDs who got it. I said this in the Dáil yesterday. You know, they got elected in their own right. They have their own names and they should be referred to as individual TDs as they are. And the second thing I'd say is that regional independent group were very clear to me that their interlocutor in government, their leader in government, is Minister Sean Canney. And it is Sean Canney who I will be sitting down with Micheál Martin on a weekly basis to discuss the issues coming up at Cabinet. And
but,
I think it's important to say that.
This deal has invited all of these headlines and analysis pieces about the Moriarty Tribunal and about corruption. You've brought that on your own head. Did you have that conversation with Micheál Martin? Do we know what we're getting into here?
Well, firstly, I fully support the findings of the Moriarty Tribunal. That's beyond question, beyond doubt, and I stand by the Moriarty Tribunal. Be very clear on that. I'm accountable for who is and isn't a member of Fine Gael. In terms of other groupings in the Dáil, it is a matter for those groupings to decide their members. And of course, it's a matter for the people of individual constituencies to decide who joins those groups.
No, but you decided. You decided, Michael Lowry, we're going to do a deal with a group that includes him, whether you accept he's leading it or not. We're going to, in doing that, there will be people who voted for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael who never heard of the Moriarty Tribunal, who now have read all about it and they know about it, and they're connecting it with you, and they're connecting it with this government.
Well, I don't think anyone's connecting the Moriarty Tribunal with me, just to be fair, in relation to something that happened back when I was a child.
But you've accepted Michael Lowry into this government.
That's a different matter.
But it has to be a factor in your decision making here.
Well, look, what was absolutely a factor in my decision making was how do you form a stable government? And it is a matter of public record that I met with and engaged with the Labour Party, met with and engaged with the Social Democrats, and met with and engaged with the regional independents. I'm not here to slag off or attack any other political party, but other political parties decided they couldn't proceed or didn't wish to proceed with government formation. The job of the larger parties in the Dáil is to get on with the business of the people, is to create a government, deliver the government, respect the mandates people got, and crucially try to then make progress on key issues that face people. Mm-hmm. That's what you got to do. But like I was hearing regularly when I turned on RT Radio, I was hearing, why is it taking so long? You know, why is the government not formed? Well, one of the reasons it took so long was because we did go through a very deliberative process. We did meet with multiple parties. We did discuss policy in detail. And that's given us a government that I now believe will be stable, that has a programme for government that is true to the issues that my party, Fine Gael, campaigned on during the election. And I want to get on with it now in terms of trying to make improvements.
You spoke a lot about parity of esteem, but now is Fine Gael the junior coalition partner in this arrangement?
There's more Fine Gael ministers in this government than the last one, is the first point I'd make. In the last government, there were fewer
cabinet positions than Fianna Fáil.
That's also
true. Because they got more seats than you.
Yeah, no, but both things are true. And I'm a Democrat. And when people get more seats than you, that does need to be reflected. You know, representation in the Dáil matters. But no, this is a government based on parity of esteem. And sometimes maybe that phrase is misunderstood.
But you're only going to be Taoiseach for 2 years, not three.
It's a division of 2.25 to 2.75. But people in Ireland are not exercised about this. What they're exercised about is the government stable? In other words, are these people going to be able to get on with the people's business for the next number of years? And crucially, what are they going to do?
So you see yourself as Micheál Martin's equal?
Well, yes, there's two coalition leaders in this government, myself and Micheál Martin. And I think that's how he sees it as well.
Do you think, given that he got more seats than you in the election?
And he couldn't form a government without the Fine Gael Party, and the Fine Gael Party couldn't form a government without the Fianna Fáil Party. And that's what parity of esteem means. And it also means showing maturity and actually putting the interests of the country first. Mm-hmm. I remember, I often remember, and if you don't mind me saying so, I often recount to some members of my own team that I sat in this studio with you about maybe a year before the election, I wasn't yet leader of Fine Gael. And I remember you asking me, would I be happy to lead Fine Gael after the election in opposition? And I suppose I'd make the point sitting back in this studio today that I've now led my party back into government, that the leader of Fine Gael will be Taoiseach or Taoiseach for every day of the next 5 years, and that we have entered government for a fourth time. A very different vista to what was predicted a year or 18 months ago.
Let's talk about some of those challenges that you face, particularly in your role as Minister for Foreign Affairs and Trade. Like, what's coming from Donald Trump, we don't quite know yet, but given what we've seen over the last week, we have a fair idea now. Is your department in emergency mode in preparation for tariffs? Is that what you're doing?
I definitely wouldn't describe it as emergency mode, but it's absolutely in full preparatory mode. And what I mean by that is this. This week I brought two proposals to Cabinet to firstly establish a trade forum in Ireland where I will bring together all relevant government departments, but also people not in government, business representative groups and others who rely on trade, to share information, to work together, to monitor trends, and also to continue to make the case as to why doing business in Ireland is good. Secondly, we also brought proposals this week to establish a new strategic economic advisory group in the United States, where Irish people involved in business or people linked to Ireland would help actually provide advice to our embassies and to our consulates there. I think we need to take a deep breath in relation to this, and we need to be calm in relation to this too. There's no doubt there are challenges on the horizon. But what have we seen from President Trump in the last number of days? We've seen he put tariffs on Mexico and then he paused them. We saw he put tariffs on China and then he did proceed with them. We saw he put tariffs on Canada and then he paused them.
For 30 days, but it does create that level of instability, which has an economic impact.
It certainly creates instability. It certainly creates challenge. But the point I'm making is tariffs are bad for people in the United States of America. They're bad for many people who voted for President Trump, because actually there are lots of people, about 115,000 people will wake up in the United States of America this morning and they will go to work in Irish-owned firms right across the US, yep, every one of the 50 states. Last year, Irish companies invested $323 million in the United States. This is a two-way relationship. And while President Trump has a view, and he's the democratically elected president of the United States, we can do business with this administration because before the election and after the election, the US and the EU, the US and Ireland are interdependent. And that is the economic reality.
We spoke to a business owner who explained what happened to her when tariffs were introduced overnight the last time. And she had to find tens of thousands of euro overnight to get her products in there. What are you going to do if tariffs happen? How are you going to get around state aid rules? Will there be any help for those people who will have to magic up, you know, up to 100 grand to get a reasonably short, small shipment into the United States?
So we will absolutely be continuing to support Irish companies in their involvement in exports. And we have a very strong track record through Enterprise Ireland and through our state agencies of always supporting and responding to challenges. I don't wish to compare this to Brexit, because I don't think we should catastrophise this issue. But I would use that as a reference point as to where Team Ireland had shown a willingness to find a way forward and to support Irish businesses.
But will there be cash flow help for people if tariffs come in overnight?
I'm not going to start kind of getting ahead of ourselves, other than to make very clear that we will absolutely be supporting Irish businesses. Mm-hmm. But can I also say this? We've done an awful lot of things to prepare for this, and not to go back to the general election, but you'll remember there was a big focus in the general election about spending plans, about have you set money aside? What happens if there is a shock to the Irish economy? What will you prioritise? What will you not prioritise? We've been very clear in our programme for government. We are setting aside billions of euro into funds so that if there is a shock to the Irish economy, we can continue to invest in capital, we can continue to invest in infrastructure, continue to deliver public services. We've also been truthful, Claire, about what we'd have to slow down doing in terms of tax changes as well.
Yeah. And there's the Apple money there, and we had the Exchequer returns yesterday. And, you know, if Donald Trump is looking at how much money we have, 10 billion in a month looks awful, doesn't it? I mean, the timing of that announcement yesterday, you just have to, you sort of cringe and want to put your head under the pillow.
Well, I think what President Trump, who we have to remember fundamentally is a businessman, I think what President Trump will also want to do is listen to US companies who do business in Ireland and ask why do they do business in Ireland. And they do business in Ireland for many reasons, to access our highly educated workforce, to access the European Union, one of the largest economic markets in the world. Ireland has positioned itself very, very well as a bridge between the United States and the EU. And I spoke to President Trump, I spoke to him at the end of November, and I have no doubt that he has a fondness for Ireland, that he understands Ireland and understands the positive contribution.
He didn't say he's coming for you, did he?
No, he did not.
Okay, well, we can wait for that. The EU has said, when it's looking at what it might do in retaliation, that they're going to target Silicon Valley and big tech. Now, that must be very worrying for you, because that is the backbone of our corporate business here.
Yeah, look, I think we're engaging, and I met with the EU Trade Commissioner Maro Sefcovic in Brussels last week. We'll obviously be engaging in what the EU response is in relation to any tariffs that may come on the European Union.
I suppose the question is, are we on the same page here, the EU and Ireland?
Oh, we are, and we absolutely have to be. I mean, the way to respond to any tariffs is at an EU-wide level. And remember, Ireland isn't the only country that finds itself heavily reliant on foreign direct investment or indeed trade with the United States. If you look at major EU economies like Germany, Italy and others, there is a real reliance there. But I was with Foreign Affairs Ministers last week for the Foreign Affairs Council over 2 days. There's a lot of work going on in the European Union to prepare for this, but we do have to make this point. President Trump is quite transactional in how he goes about his business, goes about his politics, for better or worse.
What do you think we can offer him to head him off?
Well, I think we can make the point, we can make this point. Yes, absolutely. Ireland and the European Union have a surplus when it comes to trading goods. That's entirely true. But actually, the United States has a massive surplus when it comes to services into Ireland and into the European
Union. But we've no indication he's going to buy that argument. I've heard that a lot. Well, but I don't know what he thinks of it. Do you?
No, and that's why we have to have an engagement. And that's why I proposed at the last Foreign Affairs Council, we need to get the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, to meet foreign ministers. We need to get an early US-EU engagement on the issue of trade. Mm-hmm. What we do know with President Trump is this. The last time a tariff agenda was approved in the first administration, we know that it actually hiked up prices for American consumers. And we do know that President Trump, I'm sure, will wish to stand by the interests of those who voted for him.
That's what you've got to hope. But just going back to the retaliation again, like if the EU takes that strategy that they're going to tackle big tech and Silicon Valley, are you going to stand up and say, no, please don't do that? That's going to absolutely affect what we do here in Ireland. Or do you agree with that strategy?
So firstly, I think it's important we actually wait to see the details of anything that President Trump proposes and that any response from the European Union would need to be proportionate. The European Union did experience tariffs from the Trump administration during his first term, and we dealt with it. We dealt with it well. I believe what's going to happen, if you want to know my honest opinion here, is this. I believe the President of the United States of America wants the European Union and member states to buy more US goods and US products. And there are opportunities, I believe, for the EU and Ireland to do more business and more trade with the United States and therefore address some of the deficit that exists in relation to goods. And I believe there is a way forward in relation to this. If people keep their head, keep their calm, don't respond to every latest comment, but actually wait for the detail of any policy proposal. And crucially, the European Union has to stick together in relation
to this. Okay, diplomatic offensive then, that's going to be another element to all of this.
Very much underway.
You might find yourself in a position where you have to apologise for calling him a gowl.
Oh no, I don't think so at all. This gets overblown entirely. This was a very light-hearted moment, I think, with Dearen.
It was in 2020.
Garrahy on,
you still
on,
said
on the
it though,
FM.
You know.
I did, but it was asked if he lost the election. Let's be very clear. He won the election. I've spoken to President Trump. I had a very lengthy conversation with him for the best part of 30 minutes, and I don't think President Trump
he didn't know you called him a gal.
Certainly didn't bring it up on the call.
Has the invitation come for the White House, St. Patrick's Day, for the Taoiseach?
I don't believe it's issued yet, but I expect it will, and there's a lot of preparatory work underway in addition to the Taoiseach.
Have you any indication that it will be issued?
I believe it will, and there's work ongoing at official level. There will be a number of trade missions to the United States to accompany and support that visit by the Taoiseach.
So I can take it then that it is going to happen and you have some knowledge that it is going to happen.
I'm always respectful. It's a matter for the White House to issue invitations.
Yeah, but you're confident it's coming.
This has happened during President Trump's last time in the White House. This happened on an annual basis and I would expect that that'll be the case again. I think it would be really important. We have very, very strong bilateral relationships with the United States, regardless of who's in the White House, regardless of politics. The bond between our two countries runs deep.
Will you be going with the Taoiseach?
I intend to visit the United States, but a different part of it, as is customary
at that time
during St. Patrick's.
Have you made contact with your counterpart, the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio?
I have written to him to congratulate him on his appointment and I've sought a call or a meeting with him and I hope that that will happen shortly.
If that visit happens, will the Occupied Territories Bill be raised by our side?
I'm not sure why it would be raised by our side because it's a...
It's something that we've been told we intend to do here, so... Surely it would be raised in that context.
But sorry, you said raised by our side. So it's a matter for Ireland and the Irish Dáil, the Irish Parliament, to decide what legislation we wish to pass. And I think that's a very important and fundamental principle for any sovereign state. Of course, it would also be very important, though, that any legislation that we do pass is understood in other countries in terms of how they do their business too. So, I mean, of course, we'll keep lines of communication open in terms of those things. But these are sovereign decisions to be made by the Irish Dáil.
Let's come back then to ourselves, Storm Éowyn. Still people without power today. It's exactly 2 weeks on. Do you believe enough has been done by the government to help those people?
It's a tricky question to ask because my instinct is that we're not as prepared as we needed to be, quite frankly. But I do believe everything that can be done is being done to get power restored. So maybe I could take the two. Yesterday morning, there were 13,000 premises still without electricity. Today, there's still 7,000. Now, I can point to the fact that there were 3,768,000 premises without electricity. Huge work has been done by incredible 3,000 staff by the ESB. Pay huge tribute to them. But I also know that if you're sitting there now and you're 2 weeks on without the electricity, the burden that that is placing on people, the real human difficulty is very, very significant. And it's now, I suppose, particularly confined to the west and northwest, largely, of our country. I think we're getting there and nearly there in terms of getting power restored fully. But it does raise, and that's why I hesitated when you asked me the question, because it does raise much more fundamental questions about preparedness for very severe weather events.
But also supporting people when they're in this situation. There was a documentary on RTE last night about the storm, which I watched at 7 o'clock. It's on the player. And just seeing children doing their homework, you know, with the little flash lamps on their heads in cold houses. And you've got parents talking about being anxious when it gets dark, trying to get everything done. I'm just wondering, do you feel we could have done more? That the government could have done more to help those people while they waited for the power to come back?
I feel we're going to have much more established and clear plans for when these situations happen again. I do think a lot was done to try and help, you know, over €800,000 being paid out in cash payments to assist people, hotel accommodation being provided, community hubs being set up, the mettle of the community, but also the investment government had made in communities really actually playing a helpful role. I was in Monaghan last week meeting the civil defence. Really good work being done there. But, got to be honest with people, in a country as geographically as small as Ireland, it is a cause of huge frustration for me, and I can only imagine frustration for people on the ground, that the response seemed to vary so much in counties. And I'm not going to name them, but in some counties, I thought the response was much better than it was in others.
Mm-hmm. And that in terms of getting the community hub set up, that sort of thing?
Getting the community hub set up, communicating with people, having structures in place to look after vulnerable
people. Is that a county council responsibility or who does that lie with?
So book stops with the government on everything, I accept that. But I do think we need to both support and ensure our county councils do take the lead in this. They are, I suppose, responsible for the local management plan. Now, book stops with government, that's not the point I'm making. But I think one of the things we're going to have to do after this storm is not just have the traditional old review, how did the storm go, that happens after every storm. This is not in that category. It's much more serious. And I think we have to ask ourselves questions about the number of generators available in communities, how we can get our schools open even more quickly.
Just to be clear, you would want every county council to answer this list of questions so that government can be sure that we're prepared.
I want to know that no matter where you live in the country, that you could, there's a standard operating procedure and that we have sight and visibility. I mean, we, the people of Ireland, in terms of where the community generators are, what the emergency plan is. With parts of the country where, and this is nobody's fault other than the storm, right? But with parts of the country where all of the telecommunication structure went down, where actually people were worried about making 999 calls, about the guards' Tetra systems not working as well. How do we, when the technology goes down, in a world that is so dependent on technology, what is the backup plan? And I don't think we've satisfactory answers.
But that's going to take investment, right? Are you expecting the council to do that out of their existing funds or will there be investment in generators and satellite telephones?
No, there'll 100% have to be investment. I mean, the cost and the damage of this storm will far outweigh the cost of any level of investment. We have to basically build up resilience and preparedness. We can't always stop the storm. We can't stop the storm, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. But we are seeing, I saw a graph the other day that shows, you know, the number of adverse weather events we used to get versus the number we're now seeing.
Yeah, it's going to get worse. It's going to be more.
And also, look, let's be honest, this is a networking of climate change too. And we've got to make sure that we're really ambitious in trying to make progress on climate
too. We had the chief executive of the ESB, Paddy Hayes, in here on the programme. Some controversy around his comments when he said that the likely costs arising from the storm will be passed on to customers. Now, your own colleague, Jerry Buttermer, said that those comments were inappropriate. Do you agree with him?
They were certainly extraordinarily insensitive, and I do agree. I mean, we can have discussions about how best to invest, including the size of the ESB's surplus, by the way, and the dividends and the resources available to the ESB. But when my constituents, or certainly citizens in the country in which I'm Taoiseach, haven't had the lights on for 2 weeks, I'd appreciate a slightly more sensitive approach in relation to these matters. The very big issues here that need to be addressed. I mean, we can't continue to have a situation where we're investing millions and millions of euro through the ESB in repairing lines when the trees are falling down on top of them. We need to have a plan in terms of how we protect the ESB's infrastructure. I think that's a really serious issue.
Just on that core point, are you saying to the ESB, you cannot and should not be increasing what you charge in order to pay for the repairs as a result of that storm?
I'm saying that you should at the very least engage with government in relation to the issue. We should see how we can find a way forward. The cost of electricity is something that stresses people in this country, something that I met people on the campaign trail. It worries people. And I don't want any person to be worried about the cost of heating the home, cost of turning on the lights. And I also don't want people, when they can't turn on the lights, be hearing the response from the state agency in relation to the lights saying, we're going to put up your bills. That's not a sensible.
This will be a decision for Comreg, won't it? Are you saying it won't happen?
I'm saying that we live in a country now where we're planning on investing a huge amount more in infrastructure. We're investing a huge amount more in our energy grid and our water grid, and we should be having a conversation in relation to these. I'm respectful of the division of responsibilities, the role of the regulator, the role of the company, but I think it would have taken people aback. And I think in a moment of reflection, the chief executive of the ESB, I'm sure, would understand why it would take people aback when they'd been without electricity for so many days.
So can you say to people now, you will not be paying for the cost of repairs from Storm Éowyn?
What I can say to people is, when it becomes apparent what the full costs of that repair is, government will have to engage with all of the various utilities and all of the various government departments, and that work will take place.
Okay, the one thing the government can do really quickly, though, is say today that the PSO levy on your bill won't be charged for the period of time that you were out of power.
And we can look at that, but I'm not in a position today to make I'm not going to make any sort of knee-jerk comments. What I am going to say is this: the priority is getting the lights back on. The priority is having a full review in relation to this storm, including looking at a local level. And then the priority has to be, how do we invest in protecting the infrastructure going forward? We have provided a lot of financial assistance, quite rightly, to people who found themselves in very difficult situations, over €818,000 as of yesterday,
but
to over 4,000 people.
Are you saying that you will consider removing the PSO levy from people's bills for the period of time that they were out of power? Can you say that much?
I'm saying we're not ruling anything out, but I'm saying that's not the priority that I hear from people. It's not the priority I heard from people in Monaghan. It's not the priority that I hear from...
Well, it sticks in your craw if you pay a PSO levy for a period of time and you've no power.
But the biggest priority is getting the lights back on, making sure Ireland is better prepared for future storms. And in general, the approach that this government will take, just like the last one, is helping people with the cost of living, helping people reduce the cost of their bills, and that will be a priority in the time ahead.
You've been accused of misleading the public over the housing targets. 33,000 was your target. It wasn't met. Now, the Taoiseach did admit during the week he got the figure wrong. It's one of the most important issues for, as you know, voters after the election. Were people misled on the housing figures for 2024 during the course of that election?
You can only be misled if you provide information to the public that you know to be untrue. It's not misleading to provide information.
Well, you know, the allegation is that you knew it was untrue.
So let's just take a step back here and remind ourselves what happened. So as the Department of Housing had made an assertion in a letter to the three coalition leaders, of which I was one, that they felt that Ireland would come close to hitting 40,000. I don't know the exact wording in front of me, but basically suggesting...
Was this the letter from the then minister,
yes,
Dara O'Brien?
Yes. And obviously that information was given in good faith, but it's a statement of fact that target wasn't reached. That's absolutely true. It's also true, though, to say that overall, when you look at the last 3 years...
That's desperate. That the Department of Housing and the Minister of Housing would give you a figure that you would then present to the public that was wrong. We've looked back now at what the CSO was saying, and the opposition has been saying this all week, but it's clear to see it was never going to be met. They shouldn't have given you that figure, surely.
I think that's true, that they shouldn't have given the figure, but I don't doubt that the figure was given in good faith. And it was given on the basis, and they referenced obviously the basis of where they were getting that hope and expectation of a larger number of houses. But I do want to say this, because I'm not dismissing the importance of the point you make at all, but I do know for people listening today wanting to know, can they buy a house, wanting to know if their son or daughter move out of the box room, wanting to know, is the government going to make big progress on housing over the next 5 years? I want to say a couple of things. I didn't meet anybody in the country in the last general election who was satisfied in relation to housing. People absolutely believe we need to do a lot more. And in many ways, they've given, let's call it the centre, of which I'm a member of a centrist party, they've given us another opportunity to deliver. They weren't necessarily
because
convinced by the
alternative.
Because
you led them to believe during the course of the campaign that you turned a corner, saying that you'd get to, you know, nearly 40,000 houses in 2024. You weren't even far above 30.
Well, objectively, Claire, in the last, and I think the electorate did recognise this, in the last number of years, we did see a very significant increase in housing supply. Not enough, not suggesting enough, but we did see a significant increase in housing supply. And right around my constituency of Wicklow, I see so many new housing estates being built. We see 500 new couples or individuals buying their first home every week. We see drawdowns of mortgages up. But can I explain to the people what I think has happened? Because I've been looking into this in quite a bit of detail. So we brought in an initiative. In fact, I insisted upon it when I became Taoiseach to extend the development waiver levy. So basically, if you agreed to commence the building of a house, mm-hmm. you didn't have to pay a development levy waiver. Make it cheaper to build a house right mm-hmm. now.
So everybody got those in.
Correct.
And they were counted then.
No,
were they?
Not the point I was going to make. What it looks like has happened is there was a displacement in the market that actually we've seen a very, very significant increase in the number of commencements whilst we didn't get to where we wished to with the number of completions. The good news, though, is under the law around the development waiver levy, all of those new homes have to be completed by 2026. So what I'm saying to the people now is there's a pipeline of 60,000 homes that have gone to commencement. And to qualify for the development waiver levy, you have to have your home completed by 2026.
And what's your target then for this year? For 2025?
41,000.
Right, but you're saying you could get to 60 now. Is that what you expect?
No, I'm saying there's a pipeline of 60,000 homes commenced. That's a fact. It's massively up on 2023. But the target for this year is 41,000.
What do you think of what Davey said, that we need 93,000 up to 2031?
You see, I think this is the challenge in relation to figures, targets, needs. What we know is we need a hell of a lot more homes in this country. But what we also know is we have to be clear on what is possible to deliver in a year. What is the capacity of the market? And we also, I think, have to look at the whole issue of the cost base of building. We have to look at the fact that it's become very prohibitive, I think, in terms of building apartments in this country. But we have set out in the programme for government that we will deliver 300,000 homes by the end of 2030. Everything has to be on the table, absolutely everything. And I'm very clear that housing is the number one priority for people in this country.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much
for coming in.
That's the Taoiseach to Simon Harris.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.